Hello and welcome to The Sacred. My name is Elizabeth Oldfield, and this is a podcast about our common life, how we live well in our deeply diverse societies, and the people behind the positions in our public conversations. In this episode, you'll hear a conversation I had with Adam Wagner. Adam is a barrister at Doughty Street Chambers, a visiting professor at Goldsmiths University, chair of the human rights charity Each Other, and host of the Better Human podcast. We spoke about why he is suspicious or perhaps nervous of the concept of the sacred, his Jewish religious practice, why human rights frameworks temper our worst selves, and why he is still a fan of Twitter. I hope you enjoy listening. Adam, I'm going to lob the conversational bomb into the interview right at the beginning, which is not asking about our gentle small talk questions, but asking what you hold sacred. And you can pick up and run with that word however you like. Some people are very familiar with the terminology. Some people react strongly against it. And there's a strong theme coming through in interviews that there's no real such thing as an individual collective sacred. It's something that we gather around. But in asking people to reflect on the deepest principles they try and live by, the things that they'd feel very compromised if they were asked to give them up, it just gives us shifts us into a different way of reflecting, really. What bubbles up for you? What are your associations with that word, or what do you think your values might be?
First of all, thanks so much for having me on the podcast, Elizabeth. It's a real pleasure, and it's a bit of a divergence from my usual podcasting. So bear with me. It's interesting because when you asked me the question, and I heard the question before, the first thing that came into my mind is I reacted against that, as in maybe I like to think that maybe I don't hold anything sacred. And I'll explain what I mean by that. I think that the way I try and go about the world is, and based on experience as well as my sort of values, is that I try not to hold anything as sacred, in the sense that I don't like, I always have reacted against the idea that there are some concepts or beliefs or, you know, worldviews which explain everything, and which are everything, and which must be defended to the death. Because I think something I've come to believe is that it's that thought process and that approach to the world that often leads to the problems we have, is believing that something that I, in my own mind, see as the answer, and for whatever reason, maybe because it's part of my religion or part of my worldview or part of my national history or nationalism, that is worth dying for. I've got a bit of a problem with that. I think I'd quite like people not to die for ideas like that. And I think too many people have died, especially in the last 100 years, because of ideas. But on the other hand, if I'm a bit less extreme about my definition of sacred, just to flip it back on myself, for me, the most important things in my life, if that's how I define it, are my family, are my community, and I think thinking in terms of concentric circles, and my, you know, the work that I do and try and do in human rights, that's my, you know, that's my vocation and that's my career. But I don't know if I'd describe any of those things as sacred.
That is totally fine. When I mentioned to you that various of my other guests had said that their sacred value is human rights, it's been really interesting, actually. I've done 65 of these now, and going back and grouping the kind of things that come up, you didn't seem surprised that human rights could be sacred, and I was interested if that is what you would say. Why do you think that is something that some people hold sacred, and how do you feel about it?
Well, Francesca Klug, who's a professor at UCL and was one of the architects of the Human Rights Act, calls human rights values for a godless age. And I think there's a lot in that, and it's really interesting, the history of human rights. People like, I think particularly human rights advocates and people who advocate for human rights often look at them as some sort of magical invention which sits outside of the rest of history, that kind of came to end history in the Francis Fukuyama sense of we've got these liberal values came from beside everything else, all this messy religion and, you know, faith and all these failed political experiments. And out of the flames, like a phoenix, came human rights, these values that we can, if we only just embed them in every society, in every part of society, that will be the end of history. We'll have finished, we'll be fine. And they therefore become almost like a religious creed or exactly like a religious creed. There's something which people, you know, that you've got the Ten Commandments of human rights, which is the Universal Declaration. And there's even a poster of the Universal Declaration that looks like the Ten Commandments. It looks like it's inscribed in stone. And these are they're the rules that we go, how we go about our lives. I'm more of a skeptic in that sense. I think human rights are a good attempt that has evolved over hundreds, if not thousands of years. You know, going back, you can take them a long way back through, and they've been influenced by, you know, yes, Magna Carta, yes, the English Bill of Rights, yes, the French Declaration of the Rights of Man, but also religious teachings, you know, in all different religions have taught, you know, things like love thy neighbor as you love yourself. That's, I think, goes back a very, very long way, back to the Old Testament, and is something which is at the heart of human rights values. But I think on the other side of that is that for people who aren't, when we take God out of the equation, and God has been, or gods have been, such a fixture in the development of human ethics and values, when you take that out, and this is, I guess, what Francesca Klug is getting at, it's still, there's still a deep human urge to rally around some sort of symbolic, almost sort of, you know, traditional, maybe tradition is not the right word, but cultural set of values, traditions, practices, which looks like a religion, but doesn't have to have a God in the background. So I think that's why people are so attracted to human rights. It's a belief system. It's a it's clear. It's written down. It has its sort of set texts, and just like religious teachings, the sort of priests of human rights tell you that if you just apply these teachings to your life and to your society, everything will be better.
I wanted to wind back and locate you in your story and get a sense of maybe some of the seeds for your preoccupations now. So I'd love to just hear a bit about your childhood, particularly if there were any big ideas in the air that were formative, you know, positively or negatively, whether that's religious or philosophical or political. Just it's lovely to hear where people have come from.
Well, I grew up in Manchester, in South Manchester, and I don't think there's anything particularly remarkable about my upbringing. I'm Jewish, and my family were very sort of Jewishly involved, although not, I wouldn't necessarily describe us as religious, although Jewish people have a strange relationship with the word religious, because I think I heard someone say about Jewish people that everybody who's more religious than you is crazy, and everyone who's less religious than you is a heathen, and every single Jewish person is on a different sort of bit of a very long spectrum, and I think that does reflect how I was brought up. But we, you know, we went to synagogue pretty much every week, to a sort of local synagogue, and I had a bar mitzvah, and we celebrated the festivals, and we always had a Friday night dinner on the Sabbath. But we wouldn't keep and we kept the dietary laws as well. So it's always a big part of my identity. I think in terms of my values, my family weren't particularly political, as in my parents were not particularly, I wasn't the kind of child who got taken to protest rallies and, you know, told, you know, every morning what the injustices of the world were. We were almost the opposite. We were just sort of left to, in that sense, to get on with things. But my grandfather, was very active in politics. He was a Labour councillor for decades and was the mayor of Manchester in the late 70s. And he was a sort of big influence on me when I was growing up. I was lucky enough to have him around. And he was also, you know, he had a very strong Jewish identity as well, and a very out and proud Jewish, you know, the Jewish people, and I've spoken about this before in the context of anti-Semitism, Jewish people in Britain have a very complex relationship with being Jewish publicly, because of the environment that we've had to be part of pretty much the whole of our history in this country, but, you know, obviously elsewhere, we've sort of, there's a strong element of let's just put our heads down and pretend we're just like everybody else, because otherwise we're going to be persecuted. And that obviously was turbocharged because of the Holocaust. Although the Holocaust wasn't, my direct family didn't experience the Holocaust because, like a lot of Jews in Manchester, we came to the country in the late 19th century to escape the pogroms in Eastern Europe. So that was my sort of, you know, that's my. And the other really big influence, I was very involved from a young age in a Jewish youth movement called Habonim Dror, which is a socialist, Zionist, left-wing sort of movement, a bit like, I don't know what it's a bit like, very sort of hippie-ish. And I was, I used to go to camps and do sort of local activities. And then I was a leader when I was a teenager. And then I went on and sort of spent a year after university running the organization. And that was a huge, the Jewish youth movement set up in the Jewish community is very strong, has certainly when I was growing up. And it's a good path into social activism. And I think that's probably, I like to think of myself in my career as being sort of very quite entrepreneurial, and I'd go out and set up blogs and charities and podcasts, and I'm very sort of active publicly. And I think a lot of that confidence came from being part of this Jewish youth movement set up.
I'm going to ask about your relationship with your Jewish identity now, and particularly in terms of practice, sort of spiritual engagement, if any. And I was interviewing Jonathan Sachs about this not too long ago, and it was really interesting because he said to me, well, we just don't often ask those kinds of questions of each other as Jews. You know, I've come from a sort of evangelical charismatic background where it's very much about how are you doing with God? You know, it's very like intense about your internal spiritual life, which has its pros and cons. But I realize there's a sort of translation problem sometimes. So forgive me if the language doesn't quite carry, but you can see what I'm getting at. Kind of there's the public Jewish identity. What does it mean for you more personally, more privately, if anything?
Yeah, I mean, Jonathan Sachs would know much better than I do, but he's absolutely right. We don't talk about belief in God. I mean, I can't speak for every Jew, but, you know, it's just not a big thing. That faith, you know, is not a word which permeates Judaism. I don't think it's practice is the byline or the byword. And my Jewish identity, which is going to sound a bit strange, potentially, particularly to Christians, probably reflects that quite well, because I don't believe in God, and I haven't believed in God. I probably haven't believed in God since my late teens, but I didn't admit it publicly and to myself, to my family, probably till my mid-20s. But I've always had a very, very strong Jewish identity. As I said, I grew up going to synagogue a lot. It was something I always enjoyed, not something I was deeply involved. I wasn't that involved in Jewish education. I didn't, apart from through my youth movement, which was almost quite, if you're familiar with it, with a kibbutz these sort of communal settlements in Israel, which was a very big deal in the 60s and 70s. And a lot of non-Jewish people went out from all over the world to live in these kind of socialist communes. That was the kind of Judaism that I practiced. It was almost like a post-God Judaism, cultural Judaism. But then when I finished with that side of my life, because I became too old to be part of a youth movement in my sort of mid-20s, I went back and actually I went to a sort of adult education courses. I spent about 4 years every week doing adult education courses, and I started going to something called Limud. I don't know if you've come across it, but it's a big Jewish learning event which happens every year I want to say at Christmas, but it is at Christmas. It's over Christmas. It's the way the Jews of England go and it's a place they go to avoid Christmas. But, you know, there's lots of good educational stuff there. And I realized that in my mid-20s that as I was sort of becoming a proper adult, that I actually had stopped learning about Judaism probably after my bar mitzvah, you know, when I was 13, because I'd lost interest. And I suddenly realized that if I wanted to go to synagogue, you know, I'd moved, like a lot of my friends, I'd moved to London from Manchester. And so I wasn't with my parents. I didn't have a synagogue that I was connected to, but I felt a loss not having a synagogue. I suddenly realized. But then I didn't know what kind of synagogue I wanted to go to. You know, what did I want to go to, an Orthodox synagogue like I grew up in, or something different? And I realized that if I didn't learn about the prayer book, about the Bible, about, you know, about the history, I wouldn't be able to make those decisions in an informed way. I would just follow my sort of familial instincts, which probably wouldn't satisfy me. So I did start a bit more learning, and eventually I met my wife, I guess, when I was 26, 27, and wished she would become my wife. She wasn't my wife when I met her, and my wife, Julia, and she came from quite a similar background. We both kept kosher, you know, eat dietary habits, even though for me it was more of a knee-jerk instinct than a value-based thing. And we sort of went on that journey together, and now we, you know, I've got two children now, and we go every week when not in non-lockdown. We go to synagogue every week. We're very involved in the community. But I don't do it because I believe in God. I guess I do it because I believe in Judaism. I believe in the religion as a means of living in a value-based community. And I love the community. I love the involvement. I love going to synagogue. I love it all, basically, but I don't do it. I do it for my sort of personal, my family's spiritual well-being, I guess, not because I believe I'm going to go to heaven at the end of it, or that there was some revelation from a God 3,000 years ago that has led to this place for me.
So fascinating. There's lots I want to ask there, but I want to make sure that we have time to talk a bit more about human rights. So tell me, what was the pull of the law? And was it from very early days that human rights was going to be your specialism, or was it a bit more wiggly than that?
Well, I never wanted to be a lawyer when I was growing up. And I didn't want to be a lawyer when I was at university. I didn't want to be a lawyer when I was working for the youth movement that I spoke about. I went to do I went to do a master's in the States, Columbia, in political science, still not in law. And I experienced the American model of the constitutional, the public lawyer. I sort of got a feel for it. And I thought that's something I'd like to do. And I was still thinking about I could do going to academia or politics or something like that. But when I was at university, when I was doing my BA, I became really, I tell you what, I mean, I think that the sliding doors moment for me was 9/11, which happened in my at the end of my first year. So when the Twin Towers, and I was studying English literature. That was my degree, and I had a kind of epiphany when that happened that I suddenly didn't. I couldn't. I wanted to try and understand what the hell was going on in the world. I felt personally under threat. For the first time, it was also during the second intifada in Israel. You know, and I was spending a lot of time there, taking kids on tours, and I was very close to some suicide bombings, and I was actually very close to the bombing in London as well, like sort of a minute away on a bus, and all those experiences, those sort of bad experiences made me. It made me very worried about how I was feeling and how other people must be feeling at that time. And I suddenly got a sense of when our societies get into this sort of threat stage, this threat mode, things can start to change quite rapidly and things can start to break down and we can do bad things to each other. And I know that that's hardly an original thought. And I've read that. And I'd read a lot about that in political science and politics, but I suddenly understood how it could happen. And at that point, I thought, well, I've got to try and find a way of engaging with the world, which is, you know, which secures the kind of values and rules to help people get through those times. And that's why I came to human rights through philosophy. So through Immanuel Kant and John Rawls and these kind of thinkers who were very, who led to liberalism, Locke, you know, the idea being it's the times when people are hunkered down into their sacred groups. This is my problem with the idea of sacredness. When people are hunkered down to their sacred groups, against the other sacred groups, that you lose when society loses the ability to mediate between those groups, we end up killing each other. We end up torturing each other. We end up, abusing each other. And as a Jewish person, it's kind of, you know, our recent history is so, you know, it's full of that. It's full of that lesson. That is the lesson of the Holocaust, is that if you have societies where it's possible, for a minority or for a hated group to be exterminated, then you've lost, you lose everything. So I guess that's a slightly roundabout way of saying that I just came across this idea of human rights as you put in place this framework of values and you embed it in the institutions of societies and between societies to mediate between it. And I think human rights is actually very realist. I don't think it's a utopian at all. You know, if you talk about the history of human rights, you look at where they came from. This is, you know, the modern human rights system was developed immediately after the Second World War. You know, in it was a direct response to the atrocities and the horrendous death toll of the Second World War, but not only that, of the First World War, of the Depression, of the Spanish flu. You know, all of these crises, and the world came together and said, just in a kind of moment of clarity, and said, we need to try and do so. We need to change something fundamentally about the way we engage with each other as nations, as societies, within societies. That's where it came from. It's not utopian at all. It's a way of saying we can't be trusted in these moments of extreme emotion and anger. We can't be trusted. We have to help ourselves by putting in place these structures and these frameworks. So, you know,
that is so helpful, and you've really helped me kind of see. You've really helped me see human rights in a different way, and it strikes me that the thing that interests me, the thread I'm pulling on, is the sort of dispositions, the character, the virtue, the habits that we build to act as those kind of brakes on our worst instant impulses. And you know, I'm very interested in the Christian peace building tradition. I mean, what is it when Jesus says, "Love your enemy," when he says, "Turn the other cheek"? I'm always framing that as override your fight or flight. Like, recognize that when you are in that threat response, you will see everyone will look like an enemy, and you will either want to attack or you will want to run away. But to live in any kind of relationship with each other, whether that's within small communities or families or as citizens, you can't attack or run away. There has to be a third thing of staying in the tension. The sort of legal framework could always seem to me a kind of abstract and potentially dehumanizing part of that, that sort of had the potential to not exacerbate it, but I hadn't really seen how much having that break, having that container, so that for the moments where we can't be the people we want to be, or for those who haven't had access to spaces of formation to develop virtues and habits in themselves, that there's a hard stop. There's a line through over which you can't pass. So, sorry, that's a very long-winded way of explaining why that what you said was very helpful in my thinking. Let's dig into that a bit more in terms of conflict, difference, disagreement, tribalism, and you in your public voice, because you are a human rights lawyer, so you're working on some of these issues at that level, but you also are a commentator and a podcaster. You have a big Twitter following. How, kind of, what habits, what is the philosophy behind how you engage in public. How are you thinking about using that voice well, and what have you learned?
Just before I get to that, I just want to pick up on something you said in I thought very eloquently in response to what I just said. And I just want to highlight this, pull out this idea between the personal and the political. And I think I agree with you that if you think that just embedding a structure of rules in your society is going to solve a problem, then you're not a student of history. I'm going to bastardize George Orwell because I don't know the exact quote, but he said something like, if you know a society can, it doesn't matter what the rules of the society is if the populace wants something, you'll get it. And therefore you have a few different tracks. You have to have the personal. Eleanor Roosevelt, who was the chair of the drafting committee for the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, said that human rights begin in the small places close to home, and if they're not there, they're not anywhere. And I think in a way she was thinking of as a woman as well there, because in the 50s she's thinking, oh, this is great, men, you know, it's great for men to have rights in society, but what about women who have been excluded from society? You know, it's all very well Mr. Great Man going and spouting his human rights ideas out in public and then coming home and beating his wife up because she's not cleaned his shirt. You know, it's that sort of stuff. And I think it's you've got to figure out both. And I think religion is the best example of systems, of social systems, which have managed to sit both in the private and the political. You know, but I think there's problems with that. I mean, I speak to a lot of Jewish audiences about how Jewish are human rights. And there's on sort of liberal side of Judaism, there's a lot of talk of, well, you know, you can pull out lots of human rights ideas from the Torah and, you know, from the Talmud and from Jewish thinking because of, you know, justice being at the center and love thy neighbor as thyself and all. And that's all right. It's all true. But it's not the same. And the reason it's not the same is because Judaism is designed for Jews. It's an exclusionary and creed, you know, and all religions are, no matter how easy it is to convert, you're still asking people to convert. And you're treating people differently if they're in than if they're out. And it is different. It's not necessarily, I'm not leveling a criticism at the moment, but it is, I think that's a point of difference. And I've been engaging on social media about human rights since I started as a lawyer, so for 10 years now. Since I, you know, at the moment I qualified, I set up this human rights blog, which became very popular. I set up a charity called Each Other, which used to be called Rights Info, which is about educating and advocating for human rights sort of online. I do a podcast, but I also do Twitter as sort of my personal platform. And I do lots and lots of media as much as I can lay my grubby hands on, to try and all with the same purpose, which is basically to explain these ideas. You know, in a way I'm a bit of an evangelist for human rights, to use the religious terminology, but I think of myself as, you know, that person is, I want to be, you know, I think these values are really helpful. And they're a really good way of mediating between conflicts in society. They are a good way to understand the way we behave and to try and mitigate some of our worst attributes. So I try and be out there, you know, presenting things in that way. And I also try, because I understand. So I go back to my youth movement background because it is so influential on me, but there's this term, it's a Hebrew term called dogmatishit, which means to, loosely translated, it means to lead by example. And it's not, it's a very common sort of expression in that world. I saw that, you know, very, very clearly when I did a lot of youth leadership, and I saw very clearly that it didn't matter what you taught people with your mouth, if what you did with the rest of your body was different. And children pick up on hypocrisy, as you know, they've got a very, very keen sense of hypocrisy. They see it all the time with their parents. You know, God knows my kids see it with us. But you know, they're a good, it's a good learning process, because you've got to realize that there's no point trying to tell other people things unless you do you behave in that way, or at least you can be seen as trying to behave in that way. And and that's always been my approach on social media, to try and, first of all, to be honest, as in what my own biases are and where I'm coming from, because it's crazy to think that anybody doesn't have biases, and it's just hypocritical and wrong to pretend that you're objective. So to try and sort of be seen to be wrestling with my own biases, sort of be doing it and also be seen to be doing it. But sometimes you just have to withdraw. And that can sometimes be seen as being weak in that sort of childish social media, that bullying environment. And because you've sort of, it's turning the other cheek, basically. But I think about it as a long-term game. It's that for me, my credibility and my dignity is more important than the short-term battles that I might win. You know, oh, great, I've stood on someone now and I've crushed them, and that's just great. You know, I feel fantastic for 5 seconds. And I think those are rules for life, really, you know, just not to be the bully. I do a lot of commentary on human rights, and always have. That's controversial, but it's nothing like politics, which is really sort of dog eat dog. And I try, you know, that is a different environment.
And what makes you stay? And I have to lay my cards on the table here as a sort of, you know, someone who's also on Twitter, who has found lots of opportunity and joy in the platform, actually. But quite a lot of the wisest people I know, you know, they're sort of the old souls that I want to sit at their feet and learn from. Their line is just get off it. Like, it's corroding your soul. It's short term. It's, you know, constantly keeping us in this dopamine response. It's performing for a crowd. And the argument I always make to myself is, if you're interested in our common life and in our common conversation, and Twitter is not all of that, it's a subset of it, but it's a subset that's quite influential, I think, then to just seed the ground feels also irresponsible to me. So I'm obviously fishing for a particular answer, and ignore that. But yes, what do you think are the positives of being actively engaged, even as we know that it can turn us into people we don't want to be? And sometimes it just feels like I'm adding to the noise, frankly.
Yeah, no one comes out of Twitter unscathed, especially if you get involved in the more controversial issues. It's impossible. You come out with scars. But I think that's, you know, I've got a mostly positive relationship with Twitter still, in the sense that I've been able to have a platform that I would never have had as a junior lawyer, as someone, you know, who's unknown for, you know, for any other reason. I've been able to express ideas. You know, I'm most interested in being there to express ideas and to understand other people's ideas. And I don't think that's the same as saying you just have to listen to everybody and try and understand where they're coming from, you know, because I don't think that's quite, it's not quite the same. And I think people get a bit wrapped up in that. But, you know, I've been able to spend 10 years tweeting about something I'm passionate about, which is this human rights laws. And it's so interesting. There's so much going on. There's so many issues arise. Just to take an example, with coronavirus, when coronavirus came out, when it started to have effect in this country, I felt ready to engage with it from a human rights perspective, because I've engaged in lots of issues from a human rights perspective, and I thought this is something which human rights was designed to deal with. It's a large scale social breakdown. In every quarter, in economics, in health, in just the way we treat each other, in the lockdown, you know, human rights is designed for this. This is what it's there for, is to help us through. And I stayed very much in my lane, which I think is one of the tricks with social media, is as soon as you pull out of lane, you open yourself up to a lot more shit, to coin a phrase. Then
you risk saying something stupid so much more easily,
Because in my lane, I'm a human rights lawyer, and I know about human rights law. I'm experienced. I've been involved in lots and lots of cases. I've been in every court. I've been involved in you know, 6 public inquiries. I really get it, you know, I'm not the best, but I'm, you know, I can talk about it with authority and I can engage in authority. And if I screw up, I can tell people I screwed up and it's all fine. As soon as I pull out, you know, into the next lane, whether it's usually about politics or about, you know, the site, I've been very, very careful not to say anything about the science behind coronavirus. I know nothing. I'm not a scientist. I have no idea what the best way to deal with this horrendous crisis is. Whereas if I stick in my own lane, I can deal with that. And that's, and you can, if you can achieve that on social media, it can be so valuable and so interesting. And then you can cross pollinate with the people who know about the other stuff. You know, the scientists, the social scientists, the epidemiologists, the politicians, you know, who were all there, the journalists, who were all there and doing their bits and playing their role in dealing with this crisis. And that's where social media is, you know, it's a means of pollinating and diffusing ideas. And I think it's so great. But the problem is when you start, when you deal with stuff that is not directly, if you try and apply a framework to another issue, whether it's racism in a political party or, I guess, the trans rights debate, which is another, you know, almost impossible to engage with issue without being, without getting into sort of very hostile discussions with people, which can be very sort of, you know, unenlightening and destructive, they're corrosive. Some issues, you know, you can't just stay in the lane because people come into your lane and people sort of try and knock you off the road, basically. But I think with other issues you can, and it just, you know, I've always just taken it as a issue by issue thing. And at the moment I feel very happy on, I know if I'm happy on social media because I've not deleted the app on my phone. I go, you know, I'll delete, if I'm feeling unhappy and like, I just need to get off, I'll delete the app. And the app is currently on my phone. So that is it's a good time on social media.
You have more self-restraint than me. When I'm needing time, I'll have to delete the app. I have to put a blocker on the browser and I have to make sure it applies to all of the other devices, which is a thing to be ashamed of. Adam Wagner, thank you so much for a very illuminating and stimulating discussion on the sacred.
Thanks very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to The Sacred. I'm Elizabeth Oldfield. The producer of this episode is Soup Shop Productions, and it is a project of the think tank Theos. We'd really love to hear your thoughts, whether via Twitter at sacred_podcast, or me at TheosElizabeth, or thesacredpodcast@gmail.com if it's easier to write in long form. As always, please do rate and share so others can find the podcast. We're also now available on Spotify, so it's even easier to take The Sacred with you wherever you go. Finally, if you'd like to know more about the work of Theos, you can connect via the website at theosthinktank.co.uk.